Welcome, everybody, to Elaine's. I'm Jeffrey Higgins. My wife Cynthia's in my restaurant. We've turned this into a literary salon. I believe you're the 120th author I've interviewed since we've opened 2 years ago. We serve Alexandrian cuisine. Thank you. Yeah, it's been really nice to offer authors a place to celebrate their work. You know, it's really hard to find space, and it's hard to find an area to get together and celebrate it. It's really hard work putting a book together of any kind. And this one's very different, and I'm really interested to talk about it. We are Alexandrian cuisine. It's based on my wife's family recipes from Alexandria, Egypt. We just won Best Martini, Best Egyptian, although there's only like five restaurants in Alexandria. But we came in second for fine dining, too. So the food is really, really good. So I'd appreciate it if people ordered something. It would help keep us in business. So this will be a fun one today. Glenn Cook is an Alexandria-based writer and photojournalist whose work has appeared in national magazines and in newspapers across the U.S. A Texan native whose first job as a reporter started 9 days after he graduated from high school. You're a real slacker, aren't you, Glenn? Glenn attributes his lasting need and desire to chronicle events to his father, a visual artist and history teacher, and his grandmother, who kept a daily diary for almost 70 years. Glenn worked in newspapers for 13 years, school communications for 5, and as editor of an association magazine for 12 before striking out as a freelance writer and photographer in 2013. And that takes a lot of courage, by the way. Congratulations on that. His Substack website, Our Reality Show, features writing and photography on a wide variety of topics, including music, education, culture, the performing arts, and parenting. He and his wife, Jill, have 4 adult children and 2 grandchildren. We're here to discuss his photography book, Keep Your Distance, Walking Through the First Year of COVID. So please welcome Glenn Cook. So just to give you an idea, run a show here. We'll talk for maybe 40, 45 minutes, and then I'll come around with the microphone. We're recording this for a future podcast. We have Elaine's Literary Salon podcast. I think we've got 10 or 12 episodes up right now. And so if you're going to ask questions at the end, think of some good ones because you've got Glenn under the gun here. Now's the time to ask.
So family members that are here, please let's not talk about the past.
Definitely talk about the past. So Glenn, congratulations.
Thank you.
Why don't you tell us what your book's about?
COVID.
Did I stump you with the first question?
No. It is about the first year of COVID.
Can you hold that a little closer?
Yes, it's about the first year of COVID. And how do you publish a book about a year that nobody wants to remember? Which is, you know, if you're looking for a mass audience, that's not exactly the book you want to publish. But at the same time, it's a history lesson. And the book looks at 4 cities, Alexandria, New York City, Washington, D.C., and Richmond during the first year of COVID in photographs. Even though I'm a writer by trade, early trade, I've been a photographer for the last 15 years, and this book does not have any narrative in it other than a prologue and an epilogue. It is a true photo book.
I have so many questions because it's such an interesting thing, but first off, I know you're talking about this as history and something you want to document, but what was the motivation behind this? Like, why it's a big project.
So during COVID, when it occurred, when lockdown took place in March of 2020, the impetus for it was that I went into New York City to pick up our son Ben and Gabby, New York City was facing lockdown, and I drove into this post-apocalyptic New York City, which was New York, not crowded, not a person on the street. You can't, you never see it. It's never that way. And I just took out my camera because this was something you don't ever see. And then, like I said, I chronicle things. It's the part of my life that I just do. And then when we went into lockdown and the only thing that you could do was exercise, I started walking. Well, when I started walking, I got bored very early on with the podcasts and start walk some more, and I would pull out my camera and it was just take pictures, just daily life. And this deserted place that was nobody was there. And then it just continued. And so with my mom, with my grandmother, like I said, she was a diarist for 70 years. So I would write down the observations. I would write down what I saw. And then I just published them. I would post them on social media. Well, over the course of the year, and I did it for a year, I accumulated like 2,000 photographs. And at that point, it's like, I have this repository of this history, this year that everybody experienced. It was a common experience. I got to do something with it, but it was too soon. So I left it for 4 years. And then in 2024, I started going over it and I got a group of people together, many of whom are here, thankfully, or spouses of people that are here, to help me start cutting it. And I had 2,000 pictures. I cut it to like 500. And then this group of people helped me cut it to 120. And it was friends, it was photographers, it was people that are not from here, that are from far-flung places, that I wanted to have a look and say, look, I'm trying to capture a year. Show me.
Were the four cities that you picked just because they're in proximity to where you live?
Yes, primarily. But I mean, Alexandria, obviously, because we live here, I mean, this is where we walked. I mean, we would walk, 9, 10, 12 miles a day. And then New York is where two of my kids live currently. And then DC, obviously, because of the proximity to DC. And then Richmond, I went to meet my oldest son in Richmond for a weekend, but it was right after the memorials there had been hit during that period. And I wanted to chronicle those memorials because anybody who went down, anybody who went to Richmond, you went down the memorials and you saw memorials, and then all of a sudden they were no longer there or they had been altered for good reasons. And it was something that was part of history.
So in your book description, it says you walked 4,000 miles. Is that accurate?
Yeah, between 3,800 and 4,000 miles in a year.
And did you, how do you know that? Do you have like an app on your phone that
Yep.
tracked your step?
Yep. I tracked every week. My wife and I, we got into this competition. It was like, I walked 72 miles this week. I was like, shit. I walked 69. No. And we went back and forth. It was one of our ways of dealing with COVID was we would literally, how far did you walk today? I walked 9 miles. Did you walk 10 miles? Yeah, okay. And so it became a competition between the two of us. And yeah, who won? That's debatable.
Yeah. So your wife won. Congratulations.
Again, it's debatable. There were weeks when which I won. There were weeks in which she won, and there were commiserate things that happened back and forth as a result. But it happens. No, we it was fun. It was one way to keep us active during that period of time, which was so strange.
So I'm just curious about even the logistics of this, right? 4,000 miles, that's like basically walking to California and back, right, over the course of a year. How many miles a day were you doing?
It would have gotten me actually about, it would have gotten me a little bit more to Colorado, a little bit further than Colorado, depending on the route that you take. It ranged anywhere from 7 to 12 to 14 a day. And I mean, there are people that know me that are here tonight. I would go and sit in their park because it was like, okay, I'm going to walk 4 miles and I'm going to sit in their park for a little while and I'm going to walk 4 more miles. And, and because I'm a freelancer and I freelance writer and photographer, and I primarily shoot events. And, March 2020, they went away. They didn't come back until tentatively, the first tentative events came back in October. And that was, hey, if you want to be heavily masked and you want to work an event, you can work an event and we'll pay you nothing because everybody else is desperate. And we can get somebody else who can pay nothing and we can get them to shoot it too. So the first year of COVID, I wrote a lot and I wrote almost exclusively and lost about 85% of my business.
Yeah, it's brutal. I mean, a lot of people lost business in that, but it's so surprising. So magazines that you'd previously written for just decided they weren't going to pay anymore because there
No,
was too many people that were out there.
the magazines were fine. They actually paid. They actually allowed me to write for them. It was all about COVID, but I was able to write for them. But the majority of my business in 2019 was the first year that it had really been. I went into it in 2013, and 2019 was the first year that photography was like 70% of my business, and that all went away.
What kind of camera were you taking these photos with?
Combination. If I knew I was going to something, if I knew I was going to actually go to something, I would actually pull out my regular camera. But many of the photographs, including the cover of the book, were taken with an iPhone. And what was good about that was an iPhone at the time was about the same as the first camera that I had, first real, the real, big boy camera that I had. And, which was really crappy in low light. And you really couldn't capture motion unless you were really trying really hard. But what it did was it forced me to look at composition, and it forced me to look at technique and how it really, for me, the learning experience of using an iPhone for that period of time was it forced me to really look at my craft in a way that I hadn't had previously.
I mean, now the iPhone like 16 or whatever up to, right? 17, whatever it is, they have some really interesting things with time lapse and portrait and right in spotlight and all these kinds of things. You didn't have any of that at that
No,
time.
that was a. Actually, it's funny. There's one picture in the book that is, it was the transition from one iPhone to the other iPhone. And later in the year, the October, November, and it's a picture of a just married that's in the book. And it was taken because it was the first time that iPhone had a wide angle lens. And so I was like, oh, wow, I've got a wide angle lens and an empty King Street. Yay. I can play with this. And I just married sign. So I took that with that. But I'd say probably in the book itself, or in terms of the total of his 2,000 images, probably half are with an iPhone and half are without.
And what was the camera you used?
I have a Canon, at the time, I had a Canon 5D Mark IV. And it's a great camera. It's a professional camera. 2470, 7200 lens. I can play with both of those. And they're wonderful to work with. And you can get incredibly high res images without any trouble at all.
So when you're walking, like 12 miles a day, or whatever it was on a given day, you're carrying all your camera equipment with you, or did
On occasion, yes, and on occasion, no. But I mean, if I'm walking through Alexandria, I'd say probably 90% of the photos that were taken in Alexandria were taken with an iPhone. The photos that were taken in DC or Richmond or New York were taken with a regular camera because, one, I was there, it was something different. I wanted to actually carry a camera.
so. Early 2020, we didn't know a lot about this disease. When you were out there walking, did you have any trepidation or were you concerned about being out there?
I just wanted to get the hell out of the house.
Yeah.
I mean, that's really, I mean, to be perfectly honest, no, yes and no, because I knew, I mean, I wasn't going to walk up to a crowd of eight people that I didn't know and hug them, but I was going to, maintain distance and do what was necessary at that time. And that's what I did. So.
So you walked, 4,000 miles through our nation's cities. Did you ever have any moments when felt like you were in danger, or was there anything crazy that happened to you?
There were a couple of, not really overall, but there were a couple of times. I mean, there were a couple of times in New York. I went back in May to take our daughter Emma home. And when I walked, so that one day, there was one day that I was there and I took the 3 days because, obviously you don't have anything else to do because you don't have any events to photograph and you don't have anything else to do. And I walked like 13 or 14 miles that day. Up the Riverside from Riverside Park all the way up into Washington Heights. And There was one time that I was in this tunnel of people, and it was a tunnel that had, like, I don't know, 10, 12 people. And I was like, okay, well, I'm just going to hold my breath and just hope that nothing happens, and we'll go on from there. But other than that, no, not really, because I tried to maintain a respectful distance from people. I call it the social distancing diary for a reason, and that is that, the recommendations were that you follow that, and I did, and it was successful.
So I've interviewed a bunch of, like, journalists and photojournalists before. Your experience on the ground is obviously very different than what people are seeing on TV or what news organizations choose to cover. Did you have a different perspective on anything, whether it was from, like, some of the vandalism or the riots or the pandemic itself, that you felt like contradicted what other people thought about those events?
Yes and no. I mean, the murder, and I refer to it as the murder of George Floyd, was asinine, and it was horrible. It was terrible. And it caused a lot of conversations in our country to take place that needed to take place. And the sad thing about it is that in the long run is that we've got this revisionist history that is saying, oh, no, it was this, it was that, it wasn't what it was. And the thing about it is that, and I think I look back, and it's one of the reasons why I think the book is important, is because the book documents what was taking place. And if you look at the book and what was taking place, how can you revise that history?
So was there a moment when you were on the ground and looking at something and saying, oh, this isn't what I thought it was, for whatever the event was that you were covering?
I don't know that I was covering events. I was just walking through life. But, when we went to the White House, so Jill and I walked one day, right after, the president had done his photo op outside the church in June of 2020 and had held up the Bible and then done the photo op and then walked back in. And we walked into DC that day. And if you were to listen to the narrative that you would hear on certain media, and we can get into media if you want to, but if you were to listen to the narrative that you would hear on certain media, DC was not a dangerous place that day. There were people that were peacefully protesting. They were making statements about how they felt, but it was not a riot that, at least on the day that we were there. I can't say that it wasn't when we weren't there, but it was not on the day that we were there. They were making peaceful protests. They were making sure that people had food. They were making sure that people had water. They were making sure that people were safe. So that narrative was not told. That narrative was not seen. And yet it happened.
So, were you driving into the city or walking in, or was that part of your routine?
It was either walk into the city or ride a bike.
And so, when you're covering things like this, how do you have an idea in your mind? I know at the time you were getting out, you were getting exercise, you were taking pictures of things as you encountered them. But did you have any plan as to at the time, like say you want to cover some kind of protest, any plan as to how you do that with the camera as
No.
opposed to how you do it with
No.
pros?
To me, going in with a preconceived notion of what a story is the worst possible thing that you can do as a journalist or as a person. You go in with a preconceived notion, and 99% of the time, it doesn't turn out that way. And for me, I would prefer to watch the events unfold, analyze them, and look at them in real time, and try to tell a truthful story about what occurred rather than trying to shoehorn something into a narrative that I preconceived that should exist.
That sounds remarkably similar to journalism.
You That's how I was. I mean, that's how I was raised. I mean, in terms of this, but and the way that I was raised as a journalist, sadly, most of the people in this group know I can't fake my age. 40 plus years ago, was that that's how you do it. Today's narrative is not that.
What was the hardest part, like looking back when you were doing these long walks and you were seeing, the country in a very, turbulent time? What was like the hardest part of the experience that maybe you didn't expect?
It makes you go back and think about, for one, I mean, there's nothing like having a year on your hands, basically, to think about who you were, where you came from, how you thought, how you think, what you do. And, I have four kids who are adults, who are in their 20s and all have varying degrees of opinions about varying degrees of where we are in this life. And, some are more challenging in terms of pushing my opinions than others. And like, you're not, I'm not talking about you. But the thing is that for me, the biggest challenge in was to really look at what my preconceived notions were. And did I have preconceived notions? And in some cases, yes, I did. I mean, I grew up on the Texas Gulf Coast, and I am the recessive gene of my family, politically and socially, probably. And, in that respect, growing up there and learning, I had certain things that were part of my childhood, that were part of my growing up, my part of my experience. And it worked out, Emma and Ben and Nick and Kate all forced me to look at things differently and to look at it from their eyes. And I'm eternally grateful that they did.
Was there a moment when you were looking through the eye of your camera that you said, "I can't believe I got that shot," or "I'm so glad I'm here right now"?
Yeah, the cover of the book.
Yeah, that's very cool. Tell us about that.
All right. So the cover of the book is, believe it or not, is an iPhone shot. And it was, everybody knows we're in Alexandria right now. So Alexandria right now, 5:30 in the morning, it's sunrise, right? And I tend to wake up with the sun. I'm one of these people that wakes up with the sun when it happens. Especially if I've got a lot of nervous energy, which I did at that time. And so at this point in time, I was waking up because also this was take, I think that photo was taken in August. And in August, if you weren't out and walking by 7:30 in the morning or by 5:30 in the morning, it was going to be unbearably humid and hot. So I took off, walked to the bridge, and at sunrise, I was literally walking at sunrise. And I saw this person walking in front of me, and literally, I mean, that truly is an iPhone shot, and it was not edited. I took three of them because I saw the person walking in front of me. It's like boom, boom, boom. I can show you the photos, and it's actually the second one that's the best one of the group, and it's this person walking in silhouette. And if you look at the book cover, you can see like the. There's a mile marker for Maryland on there. And I got lucky. And that to me is what photography is. Photography is found art. It always has been found art.
No, I like that. It's a great characterization. Do you prefer taking pictures of people or places or what? It doesn't matter.
So as a print journalist, you always took pictures of people. As a, the son of an artist who never drew people. My father, my dad, it was funny because my father could never draw a person. He could draw anything else, but he could not draw a person. His people looked like these characters from some weird anime thing. And he was wonderful at drawing everything else. Well, when I started this photography journey, it was to try to capture things that my father would like. And so I always went for the inanimate objects, the things that just caught my eye. People shooting people, that's not a problem. It's easy. I mean, for me, it's just use your instinct and go. But shooting inanimate objects or shooting things or scenes, that's the more challenge. That's the bigger challenge.
I'm always so interested with authors and artists. It's such a difficult business. It's so hard to do. It's so personal. When you say you're doing it as something that your father would like, right? Like, have you dug deeper into that? Like, well, what is it about doing something that your father would like that you want to capture? What's behind that?
Well, so long story short, my father became ill when I was a child, and our childhood was dominated by his illness. And he was always curious about things, and he was always curious about art, and he was always curious about film or TV or photography. Now, he could not take a photograph that was in focus. My father could not take a picture that was in focus. I can't draw a stick figure. I have no mechanical skills whatsoever, which my wife will tell you is true by virtue of the lack of stuff that I do around the house. But I had his eye, and I could see it. And if I can see it, I can capture it. And when he died in 2007, and then we had an opportunity. I was living in New York with our son at the time in 2009, 2010. That's when I started trying to capture things that I thought he would like as a way to pay tribute. And literally, every time that I see him, every time that I see something and I click an image, I think of my dad. And it's a way to keep his spirit alive. And
Oh, that's
that's why I do it.
beautiful. That's really lovely.
Yeah.
I like that. You mentioned that this working with the iPhone, especially when you don't have all the gizmos and abilities within it, right? To do things makes you focus more on craft. Tell us a little bit about that. Like when you're looking at, I mean, there's like light and tone, for example. How does that evoke emotion from a viewer?
When you're looking at it, for me, I mean, this is just for me. Somebody said, "What do you shoot?" I say, "I shoot what I see." And one is, if you take one image and walk away from it, chances are like 1 in 12 or 1 in 14 that you're going to get what you actually thought you saw. So I try to take an image, especially if it's an inanimate object. I take an image once, and then I'll look at it, recompose it, and try to take it again, and then recompose it a third time, try to take it again, and maybe a fourth time, and try to take it again. Because your perspective, whether, I mean, I'm 6 foot tall. If I'm shooting my granddaughter, who's maybe 2.2 foot seven at best, if I shoot her from above, and if I shoot her from below, and if I shoot her from right at eye level, I'm going to get three different images that are going to be totally different. So I can take the same approach in shooting a scene or an inanimate object. Is try to shoot it from as many different angles as you possibly can. And then at that point, you should have something that works.
So you talk about like not going in with a preconceived narrative, but when you're looking at like different composition, for example, it will certainly change the way that a photo is interpreted. So when you're making your final decision by shooting from all these different angles, are you just looking at things that's the most visually striking?
Yes. Yes. I'm not looking at, I mean, I'm not. I'm a storyteller by trade, and so I definitely have a narrative that whatever, if I shoot something, I come out of that with a narrative of some sort. And I look for images that not only match the narrative, but also trip up the narrative. Because if it trips up the narrative, then it makes you think about it differently. And that's how I try to go about it. And so I don't go in with a preconceived notion of how something's going to turn out. I know that by virtue of technique, that if I shoot it a bunch of different ways, that I will then have options. But in terms of taking it, no.
In your experience, like what component of a photograph, whether you're talking about the background that you're using or where your subject is positioned or the overall composition or the light or the tone or whatever. What is it that most affects a viewer? Is it a combination of everything, or is there one thing in particular that kind of sticks out in your head?
I mean, I think that if you can get an interesting subject, that's one thing. If you can get a different take on a narrative that people have a preconceived notion about, that's another. I mean, We all play, in music, you all play the same three chords, right? Four chords is jazz. I mean, and so you always have these different, we have these preconceived notions of how everything will turn out. And we know that, I mean, I know I can walk into a room. It's like I'm going to get these safe photographs of the different people in a room. Then I can play. Because once I get the safe photographs in a room and I can then play with different subjects, then I can do something that's more artistic. We have a preconceived notion of what our expectations are. And, you know, for me, photographing anything is a matter of trying to tell a story. And so how can I tell the story in the best way possible?
Well, which is your, besides the cover, which is your favorite photograph you have in this book? Because you had, how many did you say you had? You had 1,000, 2,000?
I had 2,000. And so my committee, I mean, there are, let's see, 5 representatives of my committee, I think, here that looked at stuff. And they got it down to 120, and then I took it down to 70. And believe it or not, cutting 2,000 photos to 70 is a tough task.
So how do you, like, writers have that problem too, right? They fall in love with their words, or they have scenes, and then in the end, if it's not driving character or story, that it has to go.
Right.
So what was, like, your driving principle in editing to get down to those 70 photos?
Tell the story. Tell the story of COVID. Tell the story of your view of COVID for through a year. And you have to be willing to kill your darlings. So right now, for example, I had 20,000 words that I wrote during the year. And again, my first trade is a writer. And so initially, one of the first takes of the book had all of the narrative in it. And I was like, no, that didn't work.
Why didn't it work? Did the words take away from the photo, or were you imposing, like, your subjective opinion on what the photo said?
Yes, and. I mean, yes. And it just did not work. Because the diary entries were this series of observations about life as it took place. And for me, the art piece of it, if you want to make it art of sorts, then we all have different opinions about what that is. But if you wanted to make it about art, then it really needed to be a visual narrative of that year. And so I decided, I mean, I literally took all the words out of it except for the prologue and the epilogue, but I'm publishing on Substack right now. I have a Substack, and I'm publishing the diary entries like twice a month. Because I think it's still worthwhile. It gives me an opportunity to cross-promote the book. But it's also very worthwhile because that was important too. And I use outtakes that I didn't use in the book in those entries so people can see some of the stuff that didn't make the book.
Which do you prefer, writing or taking photos?
Both.
If you had to do one to make a living, would you give up? Which one would you give up?
Neither.
That wasn't an option.
I mean,
do they bring different things to you? Like, did you get something different, like a different feeling or different satisfaction from the photos than you get from the prose?
No. I mean, honestly, it's truly about telling a story. And for me, the two are so intermingled that I can't separate the two.
But what did you start with when you were younger?
Writing.
How old were you when you first started writing?
Well, let's see. In sixth grade, my English teacher told me to go back to print because my handwriting was so bad. No, actually, I started writing high school. I mean, probably in high school because journalism was an easy A. And I was bored in school, so writing was something. And it just, again, storytelling came naturally. I come from a family of storytellers. And so storytelling came naturally. And then curiosity on top of that, and wanting to meet and talk to different and interesting people was just something that was part of it.
So, how much of storytelling you think is genetic? Are you born with this desire to tell story, or is it something that you can teach anyone?
Oh, you can teach anyone to be mechanical about it, but I think that storytelling, much like music or acting, any form of the arts, whether it's written, visual, performance, etc., the ones that are innate, it's innate. The ones that are not, you can train them. But I mean, I've known, so I shoot a lot of dancers, right? And that's one of my weird side hobbies. And so in photographing dancers, I've known dancers that technically were proficient, but watching them dance was like watching paint dry. And they were wonderful from a technical standpoint, but from a performance standpoint, they couldn't do it. Well, the same thing applies to writing and photography, et cetera. You can be technically proficient at something, and if you're not doing it in a way that moves somebody to emotion, then why are you doing it? It's simple.
So what do you get out of it when you're actually doing it? Do you enjoy the process of it, or do you enjoy it later when people are viewing it or reading it?
Both. I mean, it's a different endorphin. I mean, I enjoy it because it's innate and it's something that I'm going to do no matter what, no matter who sees it. I don't care if anybody sees it. I'm going to do it because I do it. That's what I do.
I think that's the mark of the true storyteller, by the way, is that they're going to do it regardless, right?
Yeah.
Even if no one ever reads it or sees it.
I mean, it's just going to happen because for me, I write to process, I photograph to process. I am about as ADD as they come. This whole event has required me to focus in a way that I'm not sure that I'm going to be able to do for the next 4 days. Just a warning to my family members. But one of the reasons why I like photography is because for that 1 second, I can latch onto something and I can focus and I can shoot it. When I'm writing and I'm in a zone, in that zone, I'm totally focused. And for somebody who that is elusive in every other walk of their life, that's the reason why I do it.
Is there a trick to get into that flow state, like when you're writing?
No. My wife would tell you that she's like, "Would you please just go write? Do what you got to do." And I'm like, but a large part of it is either one, the pressure of an absolute total deadline, or two, it just hits. And when it hits, you just ride that wave. I mean, it truly is a ride the wave. And I've had times when I can write 1,000 words in an hour, and I've had times when I can write 1,000 words in a week. Because I keep on hitting the delete key because it's not it just doesn't work.
So when you're doing this book, are you in flow, even going through your photographs? Are you enjoying the process? Or now that it's done, like how do you feel about it when you look at that? You actually have this product over there, right? That took a long time. It's a year walking 4,000 miles, and now you've actually got a final product with those 70 photos in it. How does that make you feel when you hold that in your hands?
Did it. I mean, the thing is that, so I started to work on the book in 20, late 23, early 24, because the freelance world that I live in, January through March is just shit. Excuse the expression. It's just shit. I mean, there's nothing going on. And so I did a lot of work on it, and I developed the first, and that was the one that had the first, that had the narrative in it. And I knew it didn't work. And then last year, November, December, I contracted a really bad case of pneumonia and sepsis and was in the hospital for 5 days. And while recovering from that, again in January, when fortunately, if you're going to recover from that, that's a good time because there's nothing going on. I said, this time I'm going to publish it, and I wanted it to be for 5 years. I wanted something out for the 5 year anniversary of COVID. And so that's what I worked on when I was recovering from this, was just let's put the book together. And that was when the hard decisions got made. And it was like, okay, I know this doesn't work. Okay, this, and I know these photos don't work. Yeah, okay. And I know the production of this doesn't work. Okay, fine. Going from there.
So you self-published this?
Yes.
Did you consider going like a traditional route or a hybrid? Or you have so many options now, right, to get a book out?
Well, one, yes and no. Good luck getting a traditional publisher to look at anything. That's just not how this works anymore. Two, a hybrid, yes. But again, why publish a book about a year no one wants to remember? I mean, we're not talking about something that's going to have a tremendous amount of commercial options. If every single one of you bought one of the books, thank you. And if you haven't yet, please do, because my wife cannot wait to get these boxes out of my basement.
Are you going to publish a digital version too?
Yes, I do have, I have a paperback version that's coming out on Amazon, that's out on Amazon. And I knew this going in. I mean, I knew that the commercial prospects for this were not, I was not going to get a tremendous number of people to buy it. But I also knew that one, it needed to be published, and two, I think that people will get some benefit out of it. And that was the modus operandi for publishing it. And if you don't buy it, okay, I'm going to be fine with that. But what's been interesting is in the feedback, because now I've had this out for 2 months, and it's gone to, people have ordered it from 18 different states in three countries. And the feedback that I've gotten from it, I mean, I haven't sold a lot. I can tell you I haven't sold a lot. Obviously, we have a box right here in case anybody wants to like contribute. But the reason why, what's been interesting is the feedback that I've gotten from it is folks that have said, yeah, boy, that's eerie. That was a reminder. And then the folks that have said, you actually captured a balanced experience.
Do you think people have memory hold the whole thing because it was so
Oh yeah,
dramatic?
no question, no question. And it's funny to watch people look at it and watch actually people view through it. It's like and this is what made me realize that I had the pacing right, because they looked at it and they went, yeah, huh, I remember that. Oh shit, I remember that. Oh shit, and it's that sort of that wave, and that to me tells me that as a storyteller. One, I'm telling the story right because I'm giving you that wave that goes through. And at the same time, it tells me that if I'm telling an accurate story, then I'm telling you the real thing, what happened or what I saw. I'm reflecting my experience honestly.
So, who's your target reader for this?
Anyone, everyone, friends, family. Family that I don't know that are going to be getting copies of this if I don't sell it. No. No, but I mean, but actually anyone interested in a history, in a reflection of where we were at a certain time at this point in life. So because it's so traumatic and dark for a lot of people, how do you market that to them? Because I mean, obviously, any historical record of a traumatic event is important. But how do you go out there from the marketing side and try to get people to buy it?
I look at it from the standpoint of, look, I'm no different from anybody else, except that I experienced this just as you did, right? And I want you to look at it through my eyes. I'm not making any judgments. I'm not making any, I'm not trying to politicize this in any way. I'm not trying to make you turn to my view. I'm not trying to become your view. I just want you to see what I experienced. And if you see what I experienced and it causes you to reflect, it causes you to think, it causes you to look at something else, yay.
Do you think that triggers empathy in the viewer?
One would hope.
And so, I mean, it's a big book, right? And it's hardcover and it's photos, which are crazy expensive, like in the publishing process. How did you kind of balance that with how big you wanted the book to be? And I mean, obviously, you were cutting and editing based on story, right? But
Right.
how'd you balance that?
Okay, so everybody here who knows me at all, and I think most of you sort of do, know that I'm a huge music fan. Vinyl has made a resurrection. Yay. And if this does not land on your coffee table, you can file it away with your vinyl records very nicely. And that was partially intentional. There is a song, the title of the book comes from a Richard Thompson song called Keep Your Distance. And my favorite cover is by a group, by a couple named Buddy and Julie Miller. And so when I put it together that way, I was thinking about, and ironically, the cover of the album that I was thinking about that the song is on is very similar to the cover of the actual book in terms of the coloration of it. And so I took that and said, I'm going to make this into an album cover. And I decided that I was going to do it as a tribute to music. And that way, if anybody doesn't want to have it on their coffee table, but they don't want to throw it away because, you know, I may come over to their house sometime and they want to be able to find some way to put it on their coffee table. They can put it into their vinyl shelf and it won't be a problem. But
So what else are you working on now? You're a writer, you have this Substack thing. That's how many of those are you putting out? You're putting out biweekly, is that right?
Yeah, so the diary entries are coming out biweekly, and it's going to come out through March 2026, because it's the year. I'm trying to cover the fifth anniversary whole year. In terms of what else am I working on? Well, let's see. I've shot like three or four conferences. Got some dance stuff. Lee, you and I need to talk. And I'm just photographing whatever I can photograph and then picking up the random writing assignment wherever I can pick it up. But then I also write on the Substack every week. Substack goes out every week.
Is that a subscription Substack or
Yeah,
is it paid?
you could, well, it's a combination. You can subscribe to it, and I hope you will. But if you subscribe, you have two options. And the thing is that, again, I'm a storyteller by trade. I want you to hear my stories. I don't care necessarily if you make me rich. It would be nice. I would greatly appreciate it. My wife would probably appreciate it more. But if you have the means to do so and you feel like you can do so, great, contribute. If you don't, don't. I don't want to segregate people from getting my stuff just because of a cost factor. There's a hell of a lot of work that goes into it, but I don't want you to not be able to access it just because you have to pay me. You shouldn't have to pay me to be able to access content.
So I'm going to go to questions in just a second. I just want to ask you a couple of things. Do you think, like, because we were talking about the iPhone earlier and how far it's come, do you think that, I mean, are people, even professional photographers, still buying cameras? I mean, the current iPhone's pretty good, right?
Yes, and the issue with any camera phone, the issue with any point and shoot, the issue with any of this is one, they can't stop motion. They're better at that than they ever have been. They're great for the grip and grin. Hey, we're going to be together. Anybody else who wants to take an iPhone photograph and send it to me about tonight, that'd be great because I can share it on social media. But there's also the factor of if you want to stop motion, you can't. They don't have a shutter. Even mirrorless, they don't have a shutter. And so they're good from the standpoint of being able to take photos of a thing. They're not good for taking photos of people in action. So there's that need. Now, I say this to you as a writer by trade, who's a print journalist who worked for newspapers and now works as a still photographer. Do you know what it's like to be not only one career, but two careers in legacy media that are disappearing commercially? It's been fun, gotta say. Been entertaining.
Speaking of disappearing careers, how does like artificial intelligence affect photography, for example? I mean, because it's getting really, really realistic, right? Where it's sometimes it's very difficult to even tell the difference. And 5 years from now, you won't be able to. So if you can imagine and create anything, at what role does reality play at that point?
I'm a you can do it. Yay. Happy. You've got the tools, you can do it. But to me, it's sort of like eating a meal that has empty calories. What's the creative part of that? Because to me, the joy of this is not in necessarily producing art in any way, shape, or form. It's the creation of the art. Because the creation of the art is what drives me at all times. And if I'm looking at AI, I mean, yeah, AI can render me extinct from the standpoint of, I will, I'm a platysaurus of some sort that will walk the earth until I don't anymore. But at the same time, what I'm doing as a craft, you can't replicate with AI.
Do you think that viewers or readers are also going to crave that human component to it? That maybe things, like you mentioned earlier with the dancers, right? They're technically correct, but maybe they're missing the emotion or the passion. Do you think that readers can also sense, or viewers can sense that in your photography?
Over time, they can. Yes, I think they can. And I mean, the thing about it is, what's interesting about this world that we live in currently is that social media has us, quote unquote, more connected than ever. So why are we so bad at communicating? And if you think about it, if you think about it from the long term, why do you think that vinyl records have come back? Vinyl records have come back because there's this desire that we have to slow the heck down and have a tactile experience. I mean, the advantage of digital is that I can access anything that I want or need immediately with a search. But the problem is that now that I can access anything that I want or need with search, I don't take the time to just enjoy it and just listen to it. I've resisted ebooks for that reason. I want, if I'm going to read a book, I want to read a physical book. I don't want to do something digitally all the time. I understand that there are certain people that do, and I respect that, but that's just not me.
Oh, interesting. I love that answer. All right, I'm going to come around and I want you to speak into the microphone though so we can get it recorded for the podcast. Questions over here.
Glenn, since the first time you opened yourself up to this many editors?
Why, yes.
What was that experience?
It was actually good because the thing is that honestly, I mean, I think I had 18 different people that looked at this, that helped me winnow this stuff down. And they were great, because I honestly believe that more is better whenever you can get it, because if you can get people that will be honest with you, will look at stuff and will give you an opinion, you have to take that opinion and absorb it, whether you disagree with it vehemently or not. You at least have to look at it and say, this is affecting somebody this way. And it's not death by committee. This was not a, you know, we're really great in the D.C. area at killing things by committee. But it was not death by committee. It was death by honest feedback. And the way that I did it was is that I sent 400 photographs to 18 people and said, give these a vote. If you like it, give it a vote. If you don't like it, don't give it a vote. And then the ones that had the majority of the vote were the ones that I cut it down to. Well, that cut it down to 120. Well, at that point, I had to start looking at it from production purposes, from other purposes, and cost purposes, and I cut it down to 70 from that. And that was brutal. But that was you guys helped me get it down to that point, which I will be eternally grateful.
My question is, was there a particular moment that you decided, I have a book on my hands? Like, what is the story of that moment? You decided, this is my book.
I always knew I had something. I mean, part of it was after a year of walking around, I mean, you know, you start to see sort of a narrative unfold, and you also start to see the fact that there's not a lot being... I mean, there's the day-to-day reporting that's being done of these things, but there's nothing that's taking a step back from it and looking at it and going, okay, well, let's just, like, encapsulate a year. Again, my father was a history teacher, so I'm like, this was an unprecedented time in our history. We need to have some documentation of that fact. And so it was after a year when I decided to sunset the diary, I knew at that point, one, I was a little bored by that point because I've been doing it for so long. But two, life was starting to come back, and I was starting to get jobs again, which meant that I couldn't pay attention to it the same way that I could. And I knew that I had a good time frame. And at that point, I was like, okay, there's a story here of some sort. Okay, so what is that story? And honestly, the next 3.5, 4 years were spent finding what that story was.
Other questions on this side?
So, Glenn,
hi.
What would be a few adjectives that you would use? I haven't seen your book yet to describe. I mean, I spent a lot of time in, like, forgetting that year in so many ways, as many of us have. And the whole Black Lives Matter thing, kind of like a secondary thing, right? The so what of that 5 years later is, it's a different question.
Mm-hmm. No.
But what would be some adjectives that you would describe having developed this book?
The first one that comes to mind is obviously isolation. I mean, we were all very isolated during that time. Second one that comes to mind is family, because we were fortunate to have our family for a lot of the time. Third was just weird. It was just so damn weird. The other one that I would use is reflective. It made me reflect. I mean, it was, for those of you who are, anybody who's a Bloom County fan, that was Beakley's Closet of Anxieties. Opened during COVID and sat in your living room, because every anxiety and everything that made you reflect and look back on that whole period was there and out in force. And so, you know, when I look back on that period of time, and at the same time, it was an opportunity. It was an opportunity for growth and for reflection, that if you didn't take advantage of that opportunity, you're missing out, because I had a much greater depth in terms of my relationships with my children, with my wife, with my, you know, with people that were significant. I was very, very fortunate to be able to have that depth that grew as a result of COVID, which was a bastardization of everything we ever knew in life.
Questions on this side?
You know, apart from being a photographer and a writer, you're, like you mentioned, you're an avid music listener. So if you had to pick either a song to kind of encompass the making of this book in particular for yourself, that'd be.
Well, one, I've already told you the title was Keep Your Distance. So, yeah.
The making of the book.
The making of the book would definitely be X's Alphabet Land. Or something by The Replacements, probably, because if anybody does not have an inner punk fan, if you really want to go into punk music, go through a pandemic. You know, it's something that will just bring it out in you totally. But for me, it was Alphabet Land, probably.
So, Glenn, this is Chad. I have a two-part question for you. You can answer the first one in private. So, selfishly, I'm wondering if you're willing to teach the Duke fan how to use an iPhone the way you use an iPhone for taking pictures, because I can't do it. It's amazing. You can tell me that one in private.
Well, actually, yes, because I'm ecumenical, but okay.
you're very generous. So maybe you answered this with the answer about the cover photo, but do you have a photograph that you are most proud of? For whatever reason, maybe the moment you captured or your technical skills came together in a way that were unanticipated, but just something that surprised you, maybe the story of that photo.
Yes and no. The cover photo was lucky. I mean, the cover photo was lucky because, and that's what, when I say photography is found art, it's found art. If the person hadn't been there, the photograph would not have been the same. And I did not digitally add them into the photograph. In terms of photos that, in terms of something that meant something to me, yes. The photos from New York at the very beginning of the book, which are of a deserted post-apocalyptic New York, as I'm literally driving to go pick up Ben and Gabby so that I can hop them into a car, not even taking the time to go to the bathroom. And I'm like, yeah, I got to shoot this. And there's this one photo from that group, and it's the going into the turnstiles at the Lincoln Tunnel. And it's totally empty. There's not a car to be found. And you can look at Times Square, and you can think of all the things about Times Square, but there's never not a car at the Lincoln Tunnel, even at 5 o'clock in the morning. And that one just, that was the thing that just really struck home with me, seeing that.
Any last question? Anything over here?
Hi, Glenn.
Hold on, got one here.
Hi, Glenn.
Hi.
I enjoyed your book so much.
Thank you.
The essence of the time period so well. Is that something you see yourself doing again? As, of course, we don't want any pandemics again. But as you have during these quotes, going through, you know, present time, slowly becoming history, do you see yourself doing this again with a time piece?
You never know. You never know.
So, Glenn, I haven't seen the book yet, but I saw a lot of the images before and the screening and stuff. And I know it's been awesome. But just before, after every operation, we always said, what do we do like, what do we do wrong, what do we learn from? If you did anything differently, what would that be?
Well, my chiropractor would tell you that walking 4,000 miles in a year was a bad idea. If there were things that I would have done differently, yeah, I mean, I probably would not, looking back on it now, I mean, again, this is in hindsight.
Right.
There were things that, because I didn't know the circumstances, that I was initially defensive with family members about, just as things were taking place. And I would, of course, go back and look at that and go, no, I shouldn't be that defensive, because
It's just things that I didn't know and I didn't understand. You know, I would have probably tried to figure out a way to do DoorDash because I could have brought some income in. I would have done a better job of cleaning the house. I can't cook, so I would never try to do that. But seriously, the thing that I think that if I were to go back, if I were to go back and relive that experience again, part of it for me was is that I was laid off in 2013. I had built a business in 2019 that was at the peak of where it was, and then it just got consumed. And when you lose 80% of your business that you worked for 7 years to build, I was not able to get out of that weirdness and that loop for a while. So if I could go back and do anything else again, it would be like, okay, I should have known something like this was coming. I can pivot, to use a word, and figure out how to do something differently. And I couldn't. I was stuck in a stasis for a long time. And so part of the chronicling, the 4,000 miles of walking, which of course became this, which is great, but really created a lot of shit for my family, for my own, you know, because I couldn't move. I didn't know how to move. And I am very blessed to have a spouse that is very patient, very kind, very loving, and forgave me for it anyway.
That's a great way to end. I love that. What's the name of your Substack page again?
It's Our Reality Show. So it's Our Reality Show on Substack or glenncook.substack.com.
So I have two requests for everybody. One, if you could just go on Amazon and rate his book, it makes a really big difference. It helps trigger the algorithm so people can actually find it when they look for it. Mm-hmm. And a few reviews will make people take a chance on someone they haven't purchased from before. And also, if you like what we're doing with Elaine's Literary Salon in a restaurant, please rate us on like OpenTable or Google or wherever you rate restaurants. We'd really appreciate it. We're a mom and pop place and word of mouth helps. Glenn, thank you so much. Congratulations.
Thank you.